From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you. And from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album. Available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week we'll meet a muralist and a composer and a difficult woman. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, we'll learn how convoluted the path to creativity can be and discover why Man's Best Friend will soon be featured at the Idlejorg. But first, if you've explored Fountain Square or Broad Ripple and seen an amazing mural, or you've seen that super colorful custom-painted Indigo bus driving around town, listen up. Contributor Pete Brown sat down with longtime mural artist, illustrator, and musician Dan Thompson to learn about his indie story, his contributions to public art here, including murals and buses, and some of his favorite spots in town for great music.
Dan, you have been in Indianapolis, as far as I know, your entire life. Is that correct?
Forever.
A grad of Ben Davis High School.
Correct.
I mean, all the different arenas I've heard your name from art to illustration, musicianship, graffiti, public art, and in my opinion, general deep thinker. When, as you think back, did you start exhibiting some creative tendencies?
I mean, I'm one of those people who's always drawn my whole life. I can't remember a time in my life when I didn't draw. I never hung on to that stuff, and I don't have any of the work from when I was like, three or four years old, but it was always there. There was never a time that I didn't draw. Comic books, as I went into adolescence, became the real impetus for just my passion, the joy I take in art, and maybe storytelling too. Although I don't think that's really where I got the storytelling bug. Music entered my life when I was 12 years old. A music director from the junior high came to my school, and the teacher poked his head in and said, "Anybody who's interested in music, there's a bunch of guys down here with instruments. If you want to sign up for the band." Hmm. And that was, they had drumsticks, and I signed up for the band.
So yeah. Jumped right into percussion.
Yeah, always.
Yeah?
Yeah, and I learned keyboard, mallet instruments as well, so I can read music to an elementary degree. I can't sight read, but that was definitely the introduction.
And then when you got into high school, you were still very interested in visual arts, right? There's a lot of art classes in high school, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I rejected art classes for a long time because when I was in seventh grade, I took my first formal art class. It was called GT Art because in the 90s, GT was a cool thing to say. It was the Gifted and Talented Arts program, and I was heartbroken when I got in there and realized we were going to be drawing plants and stuff. I didn't realize too much later that you have to be able to draw plants. Like, it's kind of an important thing. But at the time, I hated it, and I swore off art classes forever. It wasn't until I moved across town from the east side over to Ben Davis High School as a sophomore that I decided I wasn't going to pursue music anymore. I wasn't going to be in the school band anymore. And my guidance counselor said, "You have to take something, so you should enroll in this introductory art class." And I still had another elective, so I enrolled in journalism. And the journalism actually in the following year led to me. I was doing very poorly in the class, and the teacher said, "Well, you can obviously draw. So if you start working on the newspaper and start doing my cartoons, because my cartoonist is leaving, then I'll grade you based on the work you do for the paper, and you won't have to do classwork anymore."
Interesting.
So, and then the following year, I started to get a little more serious about the art classes too. But my introduction to art really, really, in terms of my education, started with journalism.
Was there a specific teacher or moment in time that lit a fire under you?
As far as my art classes, I did take a couple of introductory art classes at Ben Davis. And in my first class, my teacher was, her name was Mrs. Stoner, Angeline Stoner. And in that first class, she said, "You should really start taking classes with Larry Hurt." Hmm. And Larry Hurt was the teacher that really, I had never even dreamed of going to college. I just didn't seem possible to me. I didn't know anybody. It wasn't really a thing most of the people in my family did. So he was the first person who's – I remember being in his class and saying, I just don't think I'm an artist. I really am just a person who appreciates art. And he said, one day you're going to realize that that's not true. Hmm. And I said, I can't see myself going to college. I'd rather just get a job and go to work. And he said, you have to go to college. Like, you have to get out of this life to know what else is out there.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, I mean, I have to give it all to him. I could rattle off a couple of really wise things he said to me in my life, but Larry Hirt was definitely the guy that, without him, I don't think I'd be in this chair.
What is that lifestyle like now, to where you're working in a field that you're passionate about, and then to spin off of that, how do you juggle the work that you're passionate about with the work that is also work? You know?
Oh man, dude, that question, the timing on that question couldn't be better. So in Larry Hirt's art class, I was a junior. I met the person who is still my best friend to this day and my business partner in Fab Crew. Fab Crew is two people. That's myself and then a fellow named Benjamin Long. And I met him. He was a senior and he was into graffiti. So he had all this. I was basically unaware of it. I mean, you know, you grow up in the 80s or the 90s. It's out there because it's on TV a little bit. It's in movies. But it was the first person I ever met that was like, he does it. He could point to things in other cities. It was my gateway to a lot of things. Male acceptance, for one, because I didn't play sports and I didn't know how to talk to girls. There was no way for me to really identify with other guys my age. It's the same thing with the journalism, right? Because I discovered this world where now I could be evaluated on the merits of the things that I actually can do. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to hold myself to the standards and expectations of people that I don't identify with at all.
Right.
I suddenly had a way to relate to other people. So the big difference between us and a lot of other people is very quickly, like within the first year, it was like, well, there's graffiti, but there's this larger thing of murals, this thing of we weren't seeing it in our hometown, but we were seeing it in other cities and specifically in Europe through magazines and the printed culture, that murals was the way to go. So sitting in a studio working on a canvas, I can't explain it to you. It never turned me on. I can get into it a lot more now because I've, as you said, it's my life. But then painting outside, painting big, it just seemed meaningful. Plus, it allowed me to go out and run around and find different places in the city and eventually leave the city. And painting artwork is still the number one driver to my travel.
Yeah.
And it's great to be in a place where even today, just before I came here, you know, we're being contacted by people here locally for what we do, meaning if what you want is generic or not, maybe not generic, but something a little bit safer or generalized, there's better places to get it than us.
Mm-hmm.
But if you come to us, then the onus is on us to give you something that you can only get from us. That's a really cool position to be in because it does often challenge you to balance that work that you love and that you're proud of and that is distinct to what we do with the stuff you just do for money. I mean, the reality is, and I say this to people all the time, if the money is the reason you're doing it, there is better ways to make money. There just are. Because, again, if you're just doing it for the money, I don't think you're doing, you know, it's like if you meet a doctor, not that I'm a doctor, I don't want to compare what I do to something that important, but it is very specialized, maybe even more so than the sciences. And it's very distinctively personal. So if I'm only doing it for the money, man, you don't want a doctor or a lawyer or a chef who owes only here for the money. You want them to care about the work because the work's going to be better. So for me, if I'm only doing it for the money, I mean, I got to be honest with myself up front. I'm not here to give it my best shot. And if less than my best is fine, then okay. But you got to identify that stuff and know when you're going into it.
Yeah.
The advertising world was like that for me. It did not require my best effort. And that worked for a long time until it didn't work anymore.
Contributor Pete Brown with muralist, illustrator, and musician Dan Thompson. Dan's large-scale mural work can be seen throughout Indianapolis and at fabcrew.com. That's fabcrew.com. When pianist and composer Becky Archibald heard that the theme of the next Religion, Spirituality, and the Arts seminar would be creation and creativity, she thought, I can do anything. She decided to compose something she'd never composed before, a tango. But then she did some research, and that anything soon took on a very narrow focus, one that, surprisingly, began with a dark side. WFYI's Jim Simmons dropped by Becky's place to find out how her creative process evolved from the negative to become a work of healing.
It was Argentinian poet Ricardo Giraldez that got Becky Archibald's attention and how. His 1911 poem, Tango, contains the following.
The all-absorbing love of a tyrant, jealously guarding his dominion over women who have surrendered submissively like obedient beasts.
I just got so mad. I got so angry about it.
Oh, okay.
That it just jumped at me that I'm going to write an anti-tango, and it's going to be disobedient beasts.
So this is kind of a woman's anthem?
I think it is.
As a disobedient beast? So how did it begin?
When I was thinking of tango, think of a... And then it was more like bump, 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 bump.
But so far you're being very traditional. You're being very non-experimental just yet.
Yes, I'm trying to just be kind of beastly, working on that. Worked with that and actually am using that. But it's something like...
What you tell students sometimes is... Don't worry if you don't know where the piece is going to go next. Enjoy the feeling of being lost.
I mean, when I first started writing, I right away felt like it was similar to reading a mystery novel. You didn't know what was going to happen next, so it kept bringing me to the piano to see what was going to happen. Now, so if you're reading a novel, do you want to know the ending? If you can find a way to just enjoy and embrace and know you're going to explore things that aren't going to work out.
Right? And that's the joy of it.
And it's especially joyful when you go, yay!
Can you give me an example of a wrong answer? And can you give me the right answer?
The wrong answer. It felt like it was too jarring of a change right there.
Let me hear how you resolved it. Okay. What's the right answer? It ends slightly dissonant, am I correct on
yes,
that? And
yes.
The first one ended, had its dissonance before the ending, is that so you like the uncertainty of the ending?
Yeah.
It sounds very introspective.
What I realize is that anger produces beauty. It didn't seem to get me anywhere by just, you know, smashing out angry chords. This had heart in it. So that one has evolved into a violin-piano duet. I have a violin counter melody that's just...
Translate to me.
It's so beautiful.
Beauty from the artistry of violinist Dean Franca, who's just finished a 27-year stint with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and who's a 10-year collaborator with Becky. Becky's crafted a fine score, all right, but the fun comes when they improvise.
Maybe the first three could be more dun-dun, dun-dun, dun-dun.
Yeah, I broadened those double stops.
He's such a pleasure to work with. He just, I feel safe to be wild, kind of.
Yes, we bring out each other's wild side.
How much of it is mind reading? How much of it is hard work? And how much of it is throwing something funny the other person's way to see what they do?
It's 100% of each of those, for a total of 300%.
Have you ever had a moment where you're off script and you both think, wow, that was beautiful. And then you go like, I can't recapture that.
I often think of what we do as those sand sculptures. When it's finished, it's all beautiful, and you shake it up and it disappears and you start over again. That's how fleeting I often think the life of a musician can be.
Were you winging it at the end there, or were you?
At the end, we tried 7 different versions of it.
And this back and forth will take place even on the night of the concert.
I think we tend to push the boundaries more when it's in the moment. And hopefully there's a little electricity in the room that's not just between the performers, but from the audience as well.
So, Becky, are you happy? You said you didn't want something trite. And you didn't want something overly tango-ish. So are you pleased where it's going?
Oh, very, very much.
This is kind of a landmark time for you, though. This marks an anniversary for you.
I started writing 20 years ago for my mom's birthday, trying to make a gift for her, not knowing that I could write music.
So your gift to her was actually a gift to yourself, right?
It was. Had no idea, yeah.
And here we are, working on Tango for Disobedient Beasts.
We closed Becky's segment with a work she composed for her mother. It's called Searching, and maybe that's a good way to describe the creative process. You can hear what's become of Becky's own search when she and Dean perform Tango for Disobedient Beasts at the Christian Theological Seminary on Wednesday, February 22nd. Becky's just one of more than a dozen local artists presenting, with a reception and the art exhibition beginning at 6 p.m. and the performances beginning at 6:30. You can find out more about this collaboration from Butler University at butler.edu/religion-arts. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, and I'm Sharon Gamble. Later this hour, man's best friend gets an art exhibit at the Eideljorg. But first, Mero has added dishes to their menu from the 7 Middle Eastern and African countries affected by the recent White House travel ban, as well as a cocktail. All highlighting recipes and ingredients of the areas. Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talked with Mero's executive chef and partner John Adams, as well as sous chef Myra Church and bartender Charlie Shoemaker.
So, John, tell me a little bit about Mero and the type of restaurant, the menu, the typical sort of menu that you might ordinarily have.
Yeah, Mero represents a concept we call global soul food. We try to take food from all over the world and put it together in a menu in a kind of our own way of sharing the diversity of different cultures around the table.
So how did the new menu that we're talking about here today, the menu that features food from countries that are a part of the current travel ban, how did that come about?
Well, we went into work on Monday, which is our typical day off, to do schedules and ordering and menu planning and different administrative things like that. And we were sitting there and we were kind of down on ourselves for the fact that we were so busy. We're sort of isolated in our own restaurant. We missed the Women's March. We missed the protests at the airport on Sunday. You know, we were looking at a way to do something that, you know, within our small business.
So food, you know, is a natural, obviously. So how did the menu come about?
We decided we wanted to do something with food from at least one of these countries, and my sous chef Myra Church kind of took it from there.
So Myra, how did that go? What were you thinking when you were, you know, finding out about the dishes and how it might fit into a menu at the restaurant?
Well, it's pretty amazing to work at Mero because we have so much freedom to be creative, and with global as a descriptor, like, we can do anything we really want to do, so that's super exciting for us as chefs. And it's also something we haven't done a lot of, cooking. You know, this type of cuisine is not something we're super familiar with, but it's also a challenge, and the flavors and the spices from these regions are really incredible. And
so this is like the Arabian Peninsula, mm-hmm. Peninsula of the Middle East.
Yes, parts of Africa, Sudan, Somalia.
So tell me a little bit about some of the dishes and what you found out about them as you were looking for them. You know, why one dish and not another, you know?
Yeah, well, we were looking for things that obviously would work on our menu, that we would be able to execute and find the right ingredients for. You know, like, one of the first things we found is a Libyan dish called shakshuka, and it's sort of a spicy tomato and pepper sauce where you poach eggs in it and you dip bread in it. And we're like, that sounds fantastic. You know, like, we can definitely do that. You know, when we looked into the Sudan, we saw that they their pretty much staple diet crop is sorghum, and they eat a lot of the sorghum porridge.
We work with sorghum a lot already, and we're like, well, this is brilliant, so...
And we really get to have fun with that.
Yeah.
You know, we cook the whole seeds. We ground some into a flour, incorporate it in the porridge. We used a local sorghum syrup in there. And we needed a new foie gras dish anyway. And I like to go towards the breakfast side of pairings with foie gras. So, you know, it's a seared piece of foie gras on top of sorghum porridge with a sorghum and tamarind sauce on it.
So what other kind of dishes are there? I see the one from Yemen, which sounds like something that people might be somewhat familiar with.
Yeah, that one looked like a great entree for us, a chicken mandi. So it's a chicken that's marinated with like saffron and garlic, actually marinated with butter, which, I just got that marinated yesterday. It smelled fantastic. You know? It's got like baharat spice and dried lime. And we're going to, they usually bury it in pots and cook it with a fire like that, but that's not an option for us. So we're going to smoke it a little bit and then kind of braise it and try to get the flavors as, you know, accurate as we can.
What about the drink? So are you working with this sort of concept on the drink menu as well?
Yes, definitely. One of the coolest histories of drinks, I think, is the mint julep. So it actually was based off of a Middle Eastern cocktail of rose water, rose petal and water, and usually medicinal alcohol that made water more safer and palatable. And then through trade routes through the Middle East, that came to Europe where mint was substituted. Then it came across the ocean, and then we added bourbon to it. So,
oh, that's fascinating.
This classic American cocktail is, you know, started in this culture. So I did my take on that. It's a julep, and it's rose petal, bay leaf, malic acid, gin, and hibiscus in it. Really great flavor, very tea-like. So definitely, so I've been working on ideas with cocktails to pair with everything here too as well.
You can hear Jolene Katzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2 The Point. Why would dozens of Indianapolis area students from different high schools and faiths spend time together on a Sunday afternoon? Well, WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer is here with some answers.
Well, there was food, for one thing, Sharon. So, you know, teenagers and food, you always
Absolutely.
Get them that way. Mm-hmm. But they were really there for a bigger cause, and they're all part of the Global Interfaith Partnerships Umoja Project. And it's an organization that operates on a lot of different levels with a lot of different groups, and one of them actually connects Indiana teenagers with school children in Kenya. So these group of teenagers get together and they raise money and they help put children through school in Kenya, help them graduate from high school, essentially, is what they do. And one of their main projects to raise that money is called the Kenya Carnival. So I went to their organizational meeting. They held it a few weeks ago just to see what they're planning for this year's event, which takes place on February the 25th.
Welcome. We're really glad you're here. Come find out what you want to do for the carnival, and you can see me with any questions.
Celia Boer is the Indiana Program Coordinator for Global Interfaith Partnership. She's one of only a few adults attending this organizational meeting, and that's exactly how she wants it.
Really, from the start, this project, Kenya Carnival, has been about bringing together students from different faith backgrounds, different schools, different congregations to work together for a common purpose. And we believe that as people of faith, we're all called to help others in need. And this project allows students to do that in a very tangible way, work with their friends, get to know other people, and help kids half a world away.
First, we'd like to recognize the different groups here. Let's start with the youth leadership team. So everybody, please stand.
Since 2008, students have been promoting, volunteering, and even creating the activities for the yearly Kenya Carnival that's held at Second Presbyterian Church.
One example would be our Carmel High School Kenya Club that wanted to do face painting. So they researched all these different face painting things and came up with ideas for making like elephant faces and lions, and they've become so good at it for several years that they even do that at other festivals as a fundraiser for us. They'll have a tip jar at another festival raising money for Kenya Carnival with their awesome face painting.
One of those Carmel High School volunteer students is 17-year-old Lainey Slack. She's been active in the carnival for many years, but last summer she took her volunteering one step further. She went to Kenya to visit the students that she's been raising money to help.
I was there for 2 weeks over the summer. We were living in the village, in a village called Kisumu County, for 2 weeks. Each day we visited different schools, the primary schools that we support. And we got to go to different students' homes. So we were going to on home visits, making sure that the students we sponsor, making sure that they that their needs are being met and that all the things that they were promised initially as they became a student, sponsored student, we're making sure that all of their needs are met and that they're getting everything that we told them that we would give and making sure that their family life is okay and seeing their schools and meeting their teachers.
We work with the children who have lost one or both parents to HIV/AIDS and live in extreme poverty. Some of our students, as young as 10 or 12, may be heads of their household, responsible for feeding and caring for their younger siblings.
Definitely made me a much, I think, more grounded person. Definitely more cautious about each day, about the things that I say and the things that I do, how I kind of see things, my perception about different things. And it's definitely made me more independent and more of a leader.
Ask your group members to sign up to volunteer. You can sign up online for a shift. Your parents can also volunteer too, so don't be shy from that. Also, pick up the flyers and find out a way to promote Kenya Carnival, like in your schools or in your neighborhood, etc., etc. Break a leg.
As you can see, the kids have a good sense of humor about all of this too. And you know, Sharon, it really is a true collaboration. All these different high schools, all these different faiths. These kids come together, and that's kind of what their goal is. They want to help a high school or a student get through high school in Kenya, but they don't tell them how to do it or what to do. They talk to them. They listen to them. Their main purpose really is communication. And while they're communicating with those kids in Kenya, they're communicating with each other, which is an extraordinary thing and kind of vital at this time.
Learning more about the world, too, building bridges.
And the Kenya Carnival is Saturday, February the 25th at Second Presbyterian Church up there on Meridian Street. And it goes from noon to 4 p.m. And you can learn more at kenyacarnival.com.
That is a fantastic thing to put on the calendar to do. And we have some other things that people can do as well.
We do.
On our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
What will we do? What do you have?
Well, after you go to the Kenya Carnival on Saturday the 25th, on Sunday the 26th, you can celebrate Chinese New Year again. because
this already occurred. This is a special year. It's the year of the...
I think it's the rooster.
The rooster, which is super lucky.
It is. And this Chinese New Year celebration is going to take place at the Indiana State Museum at P. Winkle's Puppet Studio. They have their permanent home there now. And that Sunday afternoon from 1 to 4, they are going to be having Chinese snacks. You'll get to take photos with Mr. Panda Bear. They're going to be teaching crafts. And they're going to culminate the whole afternoon in a giant lion dance parade. So kids, adults, everybody of all ages are invited to come down to that to P. Winkle's Puppet Studio at the Indiana State Museum on Sunday, the 26th.
Well, Sunday, February 19th, the Pro Arte Chamber Orchestra invites you to an evening of tangos. It's Tangos in Indy. It's February 19th at 7 o'clock at Indiana Landmark Center, and it's kind of at the intersection of classical and popular music, and you're going to get to hear the Latin American version of an accordion, which is called a bandoneon, a fellow named Peter Soave. I don't know that you necessarily need to wear your dancing shoes because you're going to be listening and not dancing, but who knows, you might be inspired to go out after and do a little dancing. Once again, Sunday, February 19th at 7 o'clock, Pro Arte Chamber Orchestra.
And starting on February the 17th and running through March the 4th on Friday and Saturday nights at 8 p.m., the Mud Creek Players are presenting The Rabbit Hole. And that's that Pulitzer Prize-winning drama. It's a very kind of sad play about a family coping with the loss of their child. And many people maybe saw the movie as well. But the director, Michelle Moore, sent me an email and said, this is a first-rate production. I mean, she's always very proud of her Mud Creek Players, but this time the actors have really stepped up their game. So if you are looking for something a little more introspective, get out and support the Mud Creek Players. That's Friday and Saturday nights, the February 17th through March the 4th.
Butler University's Theater Department is presenting the Tennessee Williams classic The Glass Menagerie February 15th through the 26th in the Lily Hall Studio Theater, which is a great intimate space to see this. It's part of the classical canon of theater for really good reason. It has characters that will stay with you for weeks and months and even years. Tom, the poet's son trapped at home, Laura, the fragile sister, the handsome gentleman caller, and the domineering Southern mother who only wants the best for her children. The production's directed by Associate Professor of Theater Elena Artemiev, who grew up in the Soviet Union, the former Soviet Union, reading Tennessee Williams. So that's an interesting intersection of cultures right there. And you can find out more on Butler University's website about the Glass Menagerie.
Coming up on February 17th at the Jazz Kitchen, it's a musical tribute to the late great vocal great Cynthia Lane. She was a powerful force here in the Indianapolis music scene. Rob Dixon, Reggie Bishop, and Kenny Phelps are going to pay tribute to the fine Miss Cynthia. That's February 17th at 7:30 at the Jazz Kitchen.
The Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra is presenting its 33rd annual Celebration of Black History concert on Tuesday, February 28th at Hilbert Circle Theater downtown, right in the heart of Indianapolis. They're honoring the contributions of African American culture and artists to classical and symphonic music. Tickets are free, but you do need to go online and secure tickets, and the hall usually fills up. So if this is of interest to you, go to indianapolissymphony.org and secure your tickets now. Once again, the concert's Tuesday, February 28th at 7:30 at Hilbert Circle Theater.
If we haven't tempted you enough, then learn more about local arts events at the indiearts.org/guide website. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide.
Or join us again next week for our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, and I'm Sharon Gamble. Roxane Gay is an essayist, short story writer, memoirist, editor, and Purdue University professor. And WFYI's Melissa Davis recently talked with her about writing and life.
I wanted to start off by saying congratulations on your recent sold-out appearance at Indy Reads Books here in Indianapolis. And it was so popular, they moved the event from Indy Reads to Clues Auditorium at the Central Library. Are you finding this kind of enthusiastic response occurring throughout this tour?
Yeah, definitely. It's been wonderful and overwhelming to see so many of the events sold out and had to have waiting lists and people disappointed they can't get in. It's a little surreal because I'm just a writer, but it's also really gratifying to see that people are actually responding to my work.
And your latest collection of short stories, Difficult Women, explores complex, complicated, and difficult people. How did this collection begin?
The stories in Difficult Women are some of my older writing. And, when I began writing the stories, I did not write with the ambition of a collection in mind. I just had ideas for stories. And so the oldest story is probably Bone Density. And it's the very first story I ever had published in a literary magazine. And then I just continued. I mean, I'd always been writing, but I just kept writing various stories about the world we live in, and in particular, women in the world and the kinds of things that women often have to deal with.
And your characters and storylines in this novel are so compelling. Do the characters stay with you when the novel is completed?
Yes, definitely. It's hard to say goodbye to characters. I get very attached to them and very interested in their lives beyond the page. And so the characters linger from my short stories. They linger quite a lot, and I'm fine with that.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever go back and revisit those characters?
Sort of. I have found that the novels that I'm working on have often risen out of short stories that I wrote. There are characters I simply cannot let go of. And so I go back to them.
Well, I just read your interview with Madonna for the February issue of Harper's Bazaar.
Yes.
You actually went to her house.
I did.
And had a wine tasting.
Mm-hmm.
How do you prepare for an experience like that?
You don't. You know, I was really nervous, of course, prior to the interview. And so I did a lot of reading of previous Madonna interviews. And I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to ask the questions that she's already been asked. The reality is that she's been in the public eye for more than 30 years. And actually almost 40 years. So there is no question she hasn't been asked. And I just tried to make it a conversation and to make it interesting and to not make a fool out of myself.
How did you find her as a person?
I found her to be interesting, intelligent, very intelligent, and very good at negotiating her public image and just interesting. And I mean that in the best possible way.
Mm-hmm. I bet her house was amazing.
Oh, it's gorgeous. I mean, it's gorgeous.
Well, you're a strong feminist and you explore themes around feminism in your work. And you're not afraid to share your view on Twitter. And on Twitter, as we know, people can respond very negatively. How do you continue to speak your truth on social media while knowing some people are going to respond like that?
I don't really think about them. Certainly there are days when the harassment is such that I can't ignore it. And I just take a few days away from Twitter to regroup and to recharge. But I'm never going to live my life worried about what these petty people have to say and what they're going to do in response to what I say. For me, Twitter is primarily fun. And I really believe in the social aspect of social media. And I'm not going to let anyone take that away from me. Of course, increasingly, it gets to be so unpleasant on Twitter that I do think, how much longer am I going to do this? But for now, I'm sticking with it.
90.1 WFYI will air the radio series Historically Black this month in celebration of Black History Month. Do you know what listeners can expect to hear from you on this program?
Yes, it's a really wonderful program. It's I narrated two episodes. One was about James Van Der Zee, who is a famous Harlem Renaissance photographer. And the second episode I did was one exploring the multiplicities of Black identity.
WFYI's Melissa Davis with author and educator Roxanne Gay. You can hear some of Roxanne's most recent work on Historically Black, a radio series, right here on WFYI Radio 90.1 FM, Monday nights at 9 through February 20th. You can also learn more at RoxanneGay.com. That's spelled RoxanneGay.com. Man's best friend is well represented in Western and Native American art, as I learned recently from the Idlejorg Museum's curator of contemporary art, Jennifer Complo McNutt. Dogs, Faithful and True is the name of the newest exhibition at the Idlejorg, and in addition to paintings, sculpture, and photographs of canines, it features lots of programming to draw in new audiences.
I cannot contain myself. This is like the best exhibit idea ever.
No kidding.
And where did it come from?
Well, I had something to do with it.
I bet you did. And you tell us about your relationship with dogs apart from this exhibition.
Well, apart from this exhibition, I'm actually a dog trainer. And I have five dogs, three Labrador Retrievers, an Australian Shepherd, and a Rottweiler. And I train and compete in obedience, teach puppy classes, basic obedience, and canine good citizen classes.
So, what is that?
Canine good citizen is actually an award by the AKC.
Okay.
And you have to do 10 exercises, and they have to do with having your dog sit quietly beside you while somebody pets them, being able to leave the room and give your dog to someone while you're out of sight, mm-hmm. just in case an emergency would happen.
Sure.
You know, just behaviors that indicate a good canine citizen.
Wow.
Yeah.
How'd you get started down that path?
You know, when my son graduated from high school, I had a lot of time. And so I had just gotten a Labrador Retriever, who's now 13.
Aww.
And I started training dogs. And as I started getting into it, I started getting into advanced training. And then I was mentored by one of my trainers and started teaching with him and then competing with my dogs and then did therapy. It just kind of snowballed. You can do a lot with your dog.
Sure. Well, so. And they're so smart.
Absolutely.
So, so smart.
And they are so dedicated to us.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about so one day you were sitting around with your colleagues and you said, you know,
dogs are great.
Dogs are great.
Well, actually, we do an exhibit each year that draws a general audience. Maybe somebody that hasn't come to the Idle George.
Sure.
Somebody that thinks it's the subject matter isn't for them.
So
and try and
guitars or motorcycles.
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
So we try and have something that will really draw the uninitiated viewer into the museum. And one of the topics that came up was dogs. And it stuck because it is so appealing.
Sure.
So it was really embraced by everyone in the museum, and dogs have had an important impact on the West.
Yeah, absolutely.
And have had an important impact in Native cultures. They've virtually been part of every walk of life and are today. And I find that more and more people are becoming more interested in having dogs around for therapy, for mm-hmm. reading to kids, that kind of thing. But of course, the exhibit that we will be showing will have a lot of herding dogs, a lot of sledding dogs.
Mm-hmm. Working dogs.
A lot of working dogs, dog heroes. So the themes are companion dogs, workers, and heroes. And so loosely around that, you'll see a lot of paintings, beautiful paintings,
mm-hmm.
incredible photography, beautiful sculptures. And the thing I like about the exhibition is that not only will people be really interested in the art because they're looking at images of dogs, I can really hold their attention and I can talk about things like how active this composition is
mm-hmm.
or how much emotion this particular piece evokes because people actually want to look at the art.
Yeah, you have the head start of the arts about something that just natively grabs them.
It does. People have a lot of empathy for dogs
yeah.
and can see themselves with dogs and have a lot of stories about dogs. And there's going to be opportunities for people to share their stories. There's going to be opportunities for people to take a photograph as if they were in the Iditarod.
Ooh.
To sit and draw from the pieces that are around them in the gallery. And then there's going to be a lot of incredible programming from things like Purdue veterinarians coming down to talk about the history of dogs and art to behavioral issues with dogs. And then you'll have things like leash and collar making workshops
oh,
and
wow.
photo workshops and a lot of things that, you know, just a wide variety. There's also going to be the Humane Society is going to partner with us, has partnered with us. They're going to have their adoption wagon there. So there's going to be opportunities to adopt. My friends and I will be there demonstrating obedience and things that you can do with your dog, helping you get interested in and realizing that doing things with your dog can be, you at first you go, well, can I really do that? You really can.
There are for example?
Well, you can really get into training obedience, and it's not something that is strict and militaristic.
And it's not bad for the dog.
Oh, no. They love it. They love a job. They want to work, and it gives them mental stimulation. So you can teach your dog to walk beautifully beside you. You can teach your dog to stay when you walk away from them. Things that really make you feel fulfilled and accomplished, and they do the same thing for the dog.
Wow.
And the way that I train dogs is really reward-based. So training my dog is all about playing. I have a Frisbee with me almost the entire time. Lots of treats.
She does. It's right here next to the microphone.
So anyway, it's really going to be a exciting, fun, empathetic, beautiful, friendly exhibition.
And definitely family friendly.
Absolutely. Yeah. 100%.
Do dogs turn up as spirit animals in art?
You know, the idea of transformation in dogs isn't part of that exhibition, but we have an artist that is in the exhibition, Rick Bartow, who does a lot of transformation. He happens to also be an artist that does a lot of dogs. So you're going to see dogs that are photographed, you know, images of realistic dogs, but you're also going to see artistic interpretation of dogs.
What's the most unusual piece of dog-based art that you found in this journey?
Well, there is a badge from a Texas Ranger dog. There are a lot of sculptures that are not unusual, but, oh, I know, Cree dog blankets that are decorative blankets that were used in wedding processions.
Really?
Native American. Beautiful.
So
some really
they
beautiful.
Depict the, they depict dogs then?
Or no, they were used to adorn the dogs. And so you'll be able to see those blankets. Very colorful, very beautiful. Really gives you a sense that the dog was part of the community.
Hmm.
And there will also be, there's dog sleds. There's a lot of Inuit pieces that you can really relate to some of the dog carvings. You can see some of the prints that tell some really interesting stories that dogs were a part of. It's really quite unique. There are toys that children played with that are dogs. There are two photographs that are larger than life of children with their dogs by a contemporary artist, Shelley Mossman, and they are stunning. I can't even describe them because they're so unique. That may be one of the most unique pieces that I found for the exhibition.
Jennifer Complo McNutt is curator of contemporary art at the Idlejord Museum. Dogs, Faithful and True opens March 4th with a member preview party on March 3rd. And you can check out idlejord.org for details about talks, dog adoption opportunities, and much more. As an attorney, Kevin Munoz practices immigration law and is a specialist in international human rights with an emphasis on family issues. A Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long invited Kevin to talk about the music that inspires him.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm joined today by Kevin Munoz. Kevin, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Kyle.
And Kevin, folks probably know your name because you have a very successful law firm downtown. You specialize in immigration law.
That's correct. We like to call the area of practice crimmigration because it's the place where criminal defense meets immigration. A lot of times we work with undocumented people or documented people whenever a criminal consequence or conviction might lead to an unintended consequence such as deportation. So we defend people in deportation proceedings. Our goal is to keep families united and to stop deportation.
And you offer a lot of free legal workshops, both in the community and on your Facebook page. You do Facebook Live posts where people can go and get some information and kind of keep up to date with what's happening. That's Munoz Legal on Facebook, right?
That's right.
And Kevin, I know music is very important in your life, and you agreed to come on today and share 5 songs with us that hold a special meaning for you, correct?
That's correct. I just turned 40 on February 3rd, and the first song that I picked was actually a song that takes me back to my childhood. My dad was a gambler. He used to take us to Las Vegas as kids, and he used to take us to the racetrack as kids. And so we would go to Santa Anita. Some of my favorite memories were playing in the playground at Hollywood Park. I spent my childhood in Los Angeles. And so one of the songs I vividly remember moving me when I was a kid was the song by Kenny Rogers called The Gambler. My dad just recently passed away, and so I carry any memory I have that he gave me as even more valuable or special now.
And somewhere in the darkness, the gambler, he broke even. But in his final words, I found an ace that I could keep. You got to know when to hold up, know when to fold up.
And the second song that I chose was the song Beach Street Breakdown. It was from the soundtrack, the movie Beach Street. At this time, I think we were in Koreatown, Los Angeles, and this was the first song I ever memorized, and the first song I ever wrote down all the lyrics to. And this is really the song that introduced me into hip hop, and hip hop became a huge influence in my life and development.
Well, a picture can express 1,000 words to describe all the beauty of life you give. The world was yours to do over. I know you paint a better place to live where the colors would swirl and the boys and girls can grow in peace.
My third song is from the Funk Dubious. to me, it represents a time in my life that's sort of carefree, fun. And the reason why I like this song, it's called The Funkiest, is because I had moved from Los Angeles to Indianapolis as a teenager, and this was a group from Los Angeles, and it was also a representation of Latino rap, and there were in that group a lot of Chicano, Latino hip-hop artists, which I could identify with because I was from California. I have Latin roots. Check it. All I need to second to wreck it. My thoughts are collected, motherfucker. Expect it. I chose as number four a song called Ordo Abkeo by Raz Kaz. And the reason why I picked this song is because the lyrics were enlightening to me. They sort of preached to me and spoke to some of the deeper questions about life. The story begins like a Dickens novel, David Copperfield, I am born and on we can't all just get along. 5996 AL. My fifth and final song is an artist that I actually personally met and built a relationship with here in Indianapolis, which gave the music that much more meaning. The artist's name is Josh Garrels. The song I chose is called Farther Along. Why the good man dies, bad man thrives, and Jesus cries, cause he loves them both. We're all castaways in need of road.
And Kevin, as I mentioned, you do a lot of free information workshops regarding some of the changes going on in immigration law. There's a lot of uncertainty right now, and there's a lot of anxiety. Remind folks of your Facebook page and your website.
So we are at MunozLegal.com. That's MunozLegal.com.
Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for coming here today and sharing these five songs with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 9 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Pete Brown, Melissa Davis, Jill Dittmeyer, and Jim Simmons. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 9 after Indivisible. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we'll get a sneak peek at the Indiana Wind Symphony's Brushstrokes concert and refine our wine knowledge ahead of WFYI's Wine Fest. And of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.